Welcome to Infill, where we discuss local San Francisco politics and policy. I'm Vincent Wu, a volunteer with the YIMBY Party. We're joined by Laura Clark of Grow SF.
Hey.
Sonia Trouse of the YIMBY Party.
Hey.
Brian Hanlon of the California Renters Legal Advocacy and Education Fund.
Hello.
And we're here to talk about some of the stuff we're going to be doing after the election, and during right now, actually, in particular with the Get Out the Vote stuff. So, what are we doing this election?
So today is Sunday, and last night we had about 16 volunteers out here sticking stickers. We have these door hangers that are going to go up in every precinct around our, so we've got about 15 precincts that we're taking. So the sticker tells people where their polling station is, and we had about 16 volunteers sticking those stickers while we watched Towering Inferno, which is Sonia's favorite movie.
Second favorite movie after Speed.
and all the stickers got stuck really quickly, and so we're sort of revving up. We're going to have some canvassing going on tonight, and then we're going to have probably more than 40 people on Tuesday go out and drop these door hangers starting at 5 a.m. around the city so that people will know where their polling station is and know the candidates who we're endorsing. And we're going to be doing that with a big coalition. Sonia, you are not paying attention.
I know, guys. I know the story. Again.
Can you talk a little bit more about what the door hangers on election day are for and what they're supposed to do and, like, the rationale behind, like, why we're making such a big push for doing that at that time?
Because we have to have a show of strength. It's the same, actually. It's very similar to the opening day mass mobilization. And we did a great job. Like, within the moderates, we have the second most volunteers.
How do we stack up generally in terms of, like, political strength in the city right now?
What Sonia said is absolutely right. Right now, unions are the most powerful force in Democratic Party politics. You know, what you may have heard regarding the decline of unions is true if you're just like looking at percentage of the private sector workforce who's a member of a union. But in terms of San Francisco politics, unions are the strongest force in town. So while they were number one in terms of number of volunteers, we were number two in the moderate camp, and that is no small thing. We've only been around for 2 years. And so, like, the fact that we outcompeted everyone else other than organized labor is really quite remarkable. So thank you to all of our volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, labor, you know, their number one job is to be organized, right? That's
literally
yeah. They are organized labor. And so the other people who form the sort of, like, other parts of the coalition, people who get volunteers out, are a lot of Democratic clubs. You know, we've talked a little bit about Democratic clubs in the past, which are kind of half social orgs, half function to make endorsements and create slate cards for their candidates. A lot of the candidates then go out and, like, volunteer with the Democratic clubs. They put on parties. Justin Jones likes to throw parties. But, you know, they don't always have volunteers who necessarily want to go out and hit the pavement as much. Labor is really good about saying to their members, like, you need to get out there and hit the pavement so that we have a voice in government.
Like, who actually constitutes labor, and how do we align with them politically? I think a lot of people listening here might not be aware of the subtleties of where they fall on the spectrum politically.
One quick thing, I just wanted to get back to your earlier question about why these door hangers are important. They're not just important so the YIMBYs can show how strong we are in terms of the number of organizers. They're also important because they have our slate card, and the stickers that we were sticking on things last night show their polling location. So for every door hanger that we hang, you know, the person as they're leaving for work or getting coffee or whatever, like, oh, wait, today is a day that the American Republic might end if Trump wins. Oh, here's where I go to make that not happen. And also, oh, look at all these down ballot races. Now I know who to vote for you know, state senator or my board of supervisor or the judge, because the thing that we do in California. So to get to your other question, though, labor contains multitudes. And in fact, you know, so like there are different unions that are in different camps. Some are on the progressive camp, like SEIU 1021. Others are in the moderate camp, like the laborers. In fact, District 11 is this sort of inter-labor conflict, mostly, where you have a lot of labor aligning behind Kim Alvarenga and a lot of labor aligning behind Asha Safai. There's no really, like, one way to answer that question.
Yeah, and the other thing, like, people who align with us often are people who build things. So, you know, steel workers, the laborers is the biggest group of that. They are people who are building all of these buildings that we are interested in. People who are interested in seeing big infrastructure projects go forward.
One thing, so as Laura mentioned, right, these are the folks who are building the future of San Francisco. We talk a lot about, you know, building an inclusive San Francisco for everyone and building the San Francisco of tomorrow. Well, the folks in the YIMBY party aren't going to be the people who are literally building it. It's the laborers who are going to be, you know, doing the actual work. And so while we're trying to build a political coalition to change policy to make that happen, these are the folks who are actually going to be doing the work.
Yeah, which sometimes means that they fight against us on some things. You know, I mean, we have intra-party conflicts all the time. So, for instance, By Right was kind of killed by labor who wanted to be able to ensure that all projects that went forward were going to be union labor. You know, we were sort of like, well, you should also care about where your workforce is going to live, and this is going to be more project. We said more building is good, but they definitely sort of, in my opinion, let the perfect be the enemy of the good, but I understand why they really wanted every project that was going to be By Right to be union labor, that they have a constituency that's going to fight for that.
Yeah, and getting back to labor power, there was probably no one individual in the state of California who was more responsible for the death of the governor's By Right proposal than Robbie Hunter, who's the president of the Building Trades Council. But now, just to show you how, you know, they may disagree on certain issues, but be allied on other issues. Just a couple days ago, the Governor Brown held a press conference at the Laborers Hall, where he was introduced by none other than Robbie Hunter, where they are strong allies against Proposition 53, which is an insane proposition that would require people to vote on every bond issue, even if it's for special use districts in excess of a certain number.
Did you already talk about, did you already say that we met the League of Cities guy there?
No. Although that's... No.
And put your phone away and pay attention.
I was reading Chuck Tingle tweets. Highly recommended, everyone.
Yeah, leave that in the comments.
Follow Chuck Tingle. Yeah, we met League of Cities there. It was very tense because he's like, I'm from League of Cities. And Brian and I were like, get the fuck out. Please. So League of Cities is what it sounds like. It's mayors and city council people. I mean, it's the city that's a member of it. And normally they're totally against us because we want to take away local control, right? Cities love blocking housing and we want to keep them from blocking housing.
And let's say cities. By cities, we mean really small, little municipalities.
Yeah, little bullshit places like Monte Sereno with 3,000 people counts as a city, which obviously doesn't really. But yeah, so we saw him there and we were like kind of rude to him, but he's persevered because with 53, the League of Cities is against 53. We're against 53. It was a pretty big tent over there.
And they're against 53 because they want the big highway project still to serve their little city, because most of the people living in these little cities are commuters who work in the actual large cities. So they do need infrastructure.
And also, you know, they are all about preserving local power. Local power as understood by the local city council, the local board of supervisor, the local mayor. What they don't want to do is transfer that power away to their voters.
Or to statewide voters.
Or to statewide voters. That's, as Sonia mentioned, that's absolutely right. So their, you know, narrow focus is how do we maintain the prerogatives of the elected officials in these local areas, including bullshit cities like Monte Sereno.
53 is actually a really insane ballot measure because not only – I initially thought that it applied to when the state legislators decided to spend money out of the state budget on infrastructure projects like Caltrain electrification. But it also would apply, for instance, to the BART bond. So if 53 passed and the – you know, three counties that are involved with BART here decided to tax themselves to pay for a local infrastructure improvement, to pay for BART improvements, then if 53 passed, we would also have to have a statewide measure. And then people in Nevada City and Redding in Orange County would be voting on our taxing ourselves to build our own infrastructure, which is actually just insane.
Can someone actually speak to why 53 is on the ballot at all? Like, what motivation is there behind wanting to pass it?
It's against high-speed rail.
And as the governor laid out, it's funded by apparently a tomato farmer who is many times over a millionaire and is mostly bankrolling this because he wants to be able to stop a project.
So for 53, you know, we were invited to come and be a part of this press conference and, you know, we're encouraged to be, you know, in the group of people with the governor, partially because of how phenomenal we've been this election cycle. This has been a real sort of level up moment for us where we're getting people canvassing all the time. And everybody sort of noticed that we have a really nice looking, well-designed slate card that we're getting into the hands of lots of voters, that people are tweeting and talking about it and sharing it on social media. All of that stuff adds up to us getting invited to press conferences. I mean, that's sort of the ultimate goal.
And for those who didn't get that, a bit of an inside joke, our lit material is very well designed, and Laura Clark did the design.
I just hired my friend to do the design, okay?
You oversaw the design.
Yeah. I said, let's make it pretty.
Yeah, we have a couple pretty ones. Also, this reminds me, if you live in Richmond and you're under the age of 45, tomorrow, Monday, maybe, I don't know when you're listening to this, you're going to get a text message from me that tells you to vote for Marjan.
Ooh.
Get excited.
So today, I mentioned earlier, today's Sunday. So this afternoon, we're going to have people out canvassing. And then Tuesday morning, we're going to have probably more than 40 people dropping door hangers. That day, we're going to be doing visibility all day long, people giving out the slate card, which also happens to mention no on 53, as well as everything else. All of that adds up to parties in the evening, and then after the election. Then we sort of cross into, okay, we're not going to be focused on, you know, getting out the vote, getting out the vote, getting out the vote. So what comes next?
It'll be agitating for legislation and project by project advocacy. So back to what we had been doing last year. In particular, the affordable housing bonus program is probably going to come back. That's a real upzoning for the West Side, and we are in favor of it.
So for some of our viewers who might not know
listeners
who might not know what the affordable housing bonus program is, could you speak a little bit to what that is and why it might be important?
Oh yeah, sure. Also, mark your calendar December 8th. Okay, December 8th, all right? So come out. I think it's going to be during the day. Statewide, we have density bonus. And density bonus basically means that if you provide 10% or 15% of subsidized part of your project, then you get bonuses, either another floor or you get to ignore the setback rule or something.
But Sonia, isn't that just a giveaway to developers?
Who cares?
So that's a fine answer. But the reason that the density bonus law was passed way back in 1979 was to incent the production of affordable housing for low-income people. So you can look at the law. There's a table saying if you produce X percentage of housing that's affordable to these different income brackets, whether it's extreme low-income, very low-income, low-income, then you get a certain number of concessions. These concessions, as Sonia mentioned, might look like increased density, increased height. You don't need to have as much parking. You don't have to have the same kind of setbacks, whatever.
I want to add on top of that, all the things we're giving away are things that we should want.
Yeah.
I mean, the things that we're giving away are more units. Oh, gosh, how terrible. We are giving away more height. Oh, no. We're giving away less parking. I mean, that's a fantastic thing.
Even though this is state law, it's been state law since 1979, and the bill was just strengthened and amended this past legislative session, many San Franciscans like to think that San Francisco is somehow not a part of the state of California. Aaron Peskin, in particular, has all but dared someone to sue San Francisco because we have not been granting density bonus permits. You know, just because a law gets passed, and a good law, that doesn't mean that politics ends. We need to continue to fight to make sure that the law is enforced.
Can we talk a little bit about what the proposed legislation that would be coming up would be? It sounds like there's an already existing state bonus program and that there's a new piece of legislation out that would change this program in some material way.
Yeah, the funny thing about the state law is the state law outlines what localities' density bonus programs should look like, and it also says, localities, you have to enact a density bonus, you know, that meets these standards. So we're supposed to pass our own law that is as generous or more generous than the state version, and we haven't, and we didn't. And so what's happening, and that's what's happening December 8th. So developers, they can go to planning and go to planning commission and say, San Francisco, you don't have your own version, so we're going to use the state version. Because the cities have to do at least the state version. And so December 8th, the very first local density bonus project is going to go before the planning commission, and that's Paramount. And if you guys are familiar with Paramount, Paramount is the kind of developer that Patrick Kennedy has been working in San Francisco and around in the Bay Area for a really long time. He's politically savvy. He's well capitalized. They are in a great position to fully articulate what they want and get it. So they're really ready to go, and they're excited to be like potentially the first density bonus law, and they kind of want to make it a big deal.
Is that project going to go all the way to the Board of Supervisors?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think? Are we in San Francisco? Like,
yeah. I mean, almost every big project gets appealed up there, right? Like, one of the other interesting things to note about Patrick Kennedy is he's trying to build more housing using partially modular units. So, like, they're units that are partially factory built, and then they're assembled on site using union labor. And so part of this is to make is to reduce the construction cost and the time of construction. Because, like, one of the things in San Francisco is that even though our land costs are astronomically high and there are incredibly high impact fees that the city assesses, up to $100,000 a unit, it varies. But our per unit hard construction costs are insanely high as well. And it's going to take, you know, creative thinking, probably in the form of, like, factory-built housing in order to start lowering these costs as well.
But to be clear, the density bonus project is not the modular project. So they have two interesting projects going on. But the density bonus project is December 8th. That's when their planning commission meeting is. And speaking of, you know, ways that we sometimes don't agree with labor, although they generally are our allies, is with respect to the modular construction. From an affordability point of view, an innovation point of view, it's super exciting. But the local unions are afraid that they're going to be, you know, innovated out of a job. Personally, I think it'll cause enough more construction that they'll be compensated. And also, our goal is to get more units built. So, you know, at the end of the day, us and labor actually have slightly different goals. And so sometimes we're going to diverge.
Are there any other interesting pieces of legislation that you think we'd like to advocate for post-election?
There's going to be a lot of action at the state level again. This is the sort of year of housing. An important leader in Sacramento said this is going to be 2017 is going to be another year of housing. So there will be a lot of housing bills that are going to be proposed, and we need to be ready to mobilize and advocate for it. The NIMBY opposition is very well organized. The San Francisco and Bay Area reps hear from them, and they hear from them loudly. Peter Cohen, in particular, is on the phone with them saying, I have this many people who are at this rally opposing your efforts to make housing more affordable and accessible. You know, I am going to fight any effort that for housing entitlement streamlining. I'm going to fight any effort for density bonuses and all the rest. So we need to be we need to have more people on our side than Peter Cohen has on his side in order to get these good bills passed.
One of the reasons we, you know, are so push people to come out and volunteer quite as much as they do, because votes matter and volunteers who are getting votes matter. And then the next thing that we're going to be doing a lot is helping people form YIMBY chapter organizations in cities and towns around California, so that just as, you know, League of Cities jerks can snap their fingers and suddenly have a bunch of NIMBYs activated to fight against things, we need to be able to snap our fingers and have all of the chapter organizations for every YIMBY organization be able to immediately act and contact their reps so that things happen at a state level. You know, we've talked about a lot before that, like, all politics is really local, that each of the representatives at the state level actually only care about their constituents back in their home district. Those are the people who elected them, and those are the people who are either going to kick them out or, you know, help them go on to the next thing.
That's absolutely right. And we often hear, oh, this is, we can't solve these problems at the local level. The state has to do it. Well, like, what is the state? The state isn't just some random abstraction. The state is people who are elected at the local level. So just because land use policy is very hard at the local level, it's also hard performing it at the state level because they're still ultimately responsible to their local constituents.
Yeah, I can't emphasize this enough now that it came up. I cannot hold my tongue. I really do have a lot of conversations, I feel like, where people are like, oh, well, I have an idea for the perfect state law that's going to solve everything. Okay, the perfect state law that's going to solve everything was passed in 1982. It is on the books. It is there. And guess what? People ignore it. Because a law is nothing. It's a dead letter. It's just black and white on a piece of paper. And if localities don't care and they don't want to build housing, they're not going to.
Okay, for our listeners at home, Sonia's mentioning a very specific dead letter law from the past that everyone might not be familiar with. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
It's the Housing Accountability Act, which you've probably heard of before on this podcast. But, you know, so we got it in ourselves to enforce it, and we're doing it. But I guess the point is that laws on their own can't do it. You know, you have to have people on the ground making sure they're enforced.
You know, I'm not part of CARLA, although I cheer from the sidelines quite a bit. So the California Legal Advocacy, long name, is going to be doing a lot of stuff enforcing the AHA. Talk more about that.
Okay, so a couple things here. So it's CARLA, the California Renters Legal Advocacy and Education Fund. As soon as everyone knows what CARLA is and what it stands for, then we can just use that. So the Housing Accountability Act was passed in 1982. It is referred to internally at the Department of Housing and Community Development as the anti-NIMBY law. The law says at its core that if a developer proposes to build housing and it complies with the general plan and with the existing zoning, then the locality has to approve it. They can't condition approval based on a reduction of density, the number of units, or anything else, unless if they make very specific findings that there is a direct, quantifiable, unmitigatable negative impact on human health or safety. And so, as you know, this is basically an impossible standard for localities to meet. So while Sonia is absolutely right, this has been a dead letter law mostly since 1982, we are breathing new life and force into it. So when we sued Lafayette, we did so saying that they violated the Housing Accountability Act. We are looking for more cases across the Bay Area to try to encourage more housing development and to stiffen the spine of some of these developers who, you know, are like, oh no, the neighbors are mad. There was this, you know, ocean of white-haired angry people who, you know, don't want newcomers. They hate the young and everything else. Oh, okay, I'll just say instead of 20 homes, how about I just build 8? Is that okay, neighbors? Well, no. It's not okay. It's these types of decisions made every day in all 101 municipalities of the Bay Area are why we have this housing crisis in the first place. So we need to enforce this law.
Related, actually, coming up, there's going to be two big things, I think, coming up that there's going to be a lot of activity. Not just the specific AHBP legislation, but also we're going to be fighting a lot about the inclusionary percentage. And also, it sounds like the city is going to start putting together objective criteria to define neighborhood character. And that is something that we have to be very, very involved with. So one of the things about the Housing Accountability Act and about the governor's proposed by right bill is they both reference objective standards. And if a project meets objective standards, then there shouldn't be anything that, you know, there should be no discretion. I was at the Planning Commission on Thursday. And on this topic, Christine Johnson, our favorite planning commissioner, asked the planners to start developing objective criteria for neighborhood character because she says projects come before her and there's all these things like, does it relate, you know, to the houses around it? You know, is it in harmony? You know what I mean? These are just words. Like, so while the planning department is crafting objective standards, we need to be at their elbow constantly interrogating whether that's a worthwhile standard, right? So if they say that houses, you know, if you have a two-story neighborhood, all the houses have to be two stories, why? Why is that important? Like, what is the public goal that that achieves, and is it worth it? So that's going to be something coming up that we're that's going to need some man hours.
So this episode of Infill is brought to you by Brigade. Brigade is a new sort of social network, I guess, for voting, appy kind of a thing, where you share how you're voting and you can add little explanations for people about why you're voting for what you're voting for. So in the show notes, you can find both Sonia and I's ballots with little explainers on some things about how and why we voted the way we did. So look for that. So you mentioned the inclusionary zoning. I had, you know, some meetings recently with developers who are working on a project that's being grandfathered in under the new 25% affordable. So back in June, we passed inclusionary zoning that bumped it up to 25% goes to low income units. Permanently affordable low-income units. But there are a bunch of projects that were already in the pipeline that the idea was, well, they've, you know, been working for often like 2 or 3 years, if not more, on getting these projects underway. And to change the rules right before, you know, shovels hit dirt is not fair. Sonia, in order to stir the pot, was a little bit advocating, no, everyone should hit the wall right now.
Yeah, because otherwise what you had is a bunch of developers who had a vested interest in maintaining 12% or whatever, 13%. I mean, and if Prop C had applied all at once to everybody, no matter where they were during the process, then those developers would have campaigned against Prop C. Well, you might have noticed in June there was no campaign. And that's because Peskin and Kim went to all those developers who normally would have been against them and said, hey, how about this? Instead of spending money opposing our ballot measure, you get to do only 13%. You get to do 14.5%. You get to do 12.5%. So they basically bought off all these developers and kept them from participating, opposing Prop C, which means what happens is now, since Prop C passed, the amount of applications for new buildings has crashed. It's half of what it was this time last year. Half. And so the developers who have stuff in the pipeline, they don't care. They're just as happy. Because if new things aren't proposed, then when it comes time in a year and a half or 3 years for their projects to open, they have that many fewer apartments competing with them. It's a real disaster for us.
Well, and on top of that, all of these grandfathered in projects have an even further incentive to continue to buy off their supervisor. So, you know, this again says, why are people making donations to Jane Kim's campaign? You know, why are developers making donations to Jane Kim's campaign when Jane Kim is clearly anti-development? That doesn't make any sense. They're doing it because they're working on projects in her district and they want to, especially if it's in the pipeline, you know, by her continuing support of these projects. And these grandfathered in projects are the most vulnerable because they are the ones that people are like, well, we've already raised it to 25%. So the grassroots activists who sort of oppose and want 25% to be the new reality are deciding to take arms against all of these projects that have been grandfathered in. They're not safe right now because a lot of the activists are saying, well, we raised the rate, you know, that they're getting really agitated about these grandfathered in projects as well. It's going to be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, and Sonia said something really important about how the number of new applications for building housing has crashed. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't unpredictable. In fact, the YIMBY party, myself, so, and I believe Sonia and Laura were saying the same thing at the time, saying, hey, wait a minute. If you up the requirement to 25%, that's going to mean a lot of projects aren't going to pencil out. There are only so many high rises in SoMa that can really afford to subsidize below market rate housing. Most projects in the city, even as high as rents and as high as home prices are, it just doesn't make sense to raise the money, assume the risk, and then try to build if you also have to subsidize 25% of the units. Now, as part of Prop C, though, the 25% can be changed by the Board of Supervisors. Mm-hmm. Now, it can be changed on the Board of Supervisors based on a type of calculation done by the city controller's office. So the city economist released not too long ago estimates for what can developers afford. Now, it's going to depend based on neighborhood and based on construction type. Developers, if you're building high-rises in SoMa, can afford a lot more than if you're building mid-rise in the Excelsior. But the TLDR is that 25% is unreasonably high for almost every project. So the rate needs to be lowered in order to not stop the number of units from being built. And predictably, of course, you know, Peskin and others saying, you know, are fighting that because their goal is not to increase affordability. Their goal is not to increase the number of affordable homes. Their goal is to stop housing production. Prop C did that.
It's really hard to ask any board of supervisor now to say, can you lower the percentage affordable housing? Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're taking away affordable units, even when the, you know, ultimate result of the policy is that more units actually get built. Asking the Board of Supervisors to take a vote that looks like you're not giving more units to poor people, that's going to be a toxic vote. And the idea that this was going to be something we were going to actually expect the Board of Supervisors to be reasonable about is completely insane and naive. So naive as to say, like, these people are, like, not naive. They did this on purpose.
There was a great article on SFBAMO that addressed, which is the Bay Area's finest new news source, SFBAMO.com. By, I think Leia Beckham wrote this one, about Choo Choo's letter to the city about the city economist estimate. And the very first thing, the
Wait,
very
you
first
have to
thing.
Do a quiz. You have to do a quiz.
Okay, all right. Sonia, what's a quiz?
Okay, so Choo Choo stands for Council of Community Housing Organizations. That's Peter Cohen's organization. And they purport to be an organization that promotes building affordable housing for poor people. So, what do you think the goal of the city's inclusionary housing program should be? If you articulated goal of the city's inclusionary housing program, what do you think?
To maintain ethnic diversity in the city.
That's an idea.
Build enough housing and a lot of housing. Maximize the total amount of housing for low-income people.
That's an idea.
Yeah, so I would think exactly what you two just said. The goal is to increase racial and ethnic diversity. The goal is to build as many affordable housing units as you can. But as Sonia is getting at with a very clever quiz, that is clearly not what Choo Choo wants.
It's clearly,
all right.
Literally in their letter in black and white, they said, they wrote to the Board of Supervisors and said, they said the goal of the city's inclusionary housing policy should be to capture developer windfalls. That's it. And that means that when they're evaluating outcomes, when they're like, this policy would make 100 low-income units and developers would get rich. This policy would make 50 low-income units and developers would have a harder time making money. They're going to pick, and they have already picked the policy that will yield fewer units. These are the people that are supposedly advocating for low-income housing, and that's why we don't have low-income housing, because the fox is guarding the hen house.
Say, some of you might say, like, wait a minute, these are affordable housing advocates, or they at least identify as such. In fact, I think that's Peter Cohen's description in his Twitter handle. Why are they advocating for these policies? Aren't these progressives? Aren't these people of the left? Well, it's a very strange sort of leftism that exists in San Francisco. It's not about providing the most homes for poor people or even advocating on behalf of the interests of poor people. The progressive movement in San Francisco really took shape in the 1970s as a movement of white professional middle-income folks that had these certain aesthetic ideas of what a city should and should not look like. For them, the ideal is a type of suburban-y urban place with low-rise buildings, and it's a type of politics that views actors as good or evil, and they view developers firmly in the evil camp. So the extent to which they can prevent these evil developers from making money, that's their goal. That's why they're organizing. That's why they're active. Now, of course, this has the effect of making all of these affordable housing advocates, who are almost entirely all old white people who are homeowners, make them much, much richer because the value of their home just keeps on going up.
I feel like this is where we always get.
I know. It's like, anyway.
I know. Yeah, we no matter what topic we start on, circle back to this. So I'm going to take us in a new direction, which is the Sierra Club, which we – it's maybe actually the same direction.
Yeah. It's the same people we're fighting.
So the Sierra Club has been historically in San Francisco. So the National Sierra Club is a really great organization that's been advocating for infill development for decades. They really see, national housing policy as part of reducing people's carbon counts and reducing commutes and all that kind of stuff. But our local chapter of the Sierra Club has been an arm of these viewists, the people who really enjoy their pretty views. So John Gollinger is the person who's managing right now the So Sonia just wants to jump right in. I will just hand the mic right over.
Yeah, you guys, I don't know, do you guys remember No Wall on the Waterfront, incredibly deceptive ballot measure against a proposed project at 8 Washington? Well, that was a couple years ago. That's one of the things that led me
they don't remember it.
You don't remember, okay.
They don't.
So a few years ago, 2014?
Yeah.
So there was an idea at where currently the Bay Club is now. That's actually where Vincent and I first met, because I couldn't meet them, I joined the Bay Club for a couple months. It's very, very fancy. It's a swimming pool and tennis courts, like at 370 Drum Street, a.k.a. 8 Washington. There was an idea to build 300 units of, luxury condos. Well, those condos were going to get in the way of the view from, two Embarcadero, one of the Boston Properties towers that's office. And then also there's these red sort of townhomes that are like 3 and 4 stories. So the residents of the townhomes and Boston Properties got together to put a measure on the ballot to require... basically to kill the project. And they succeeded, and they called it No Wall on the Waterfront, and they implied to the public that there would be an actual wall, like that if you lived in the Western Addition and you wanted to take your family to the Exploratorium, you would somehow have your access blocked, which is completely insane because none of the public streets were going to be blocked at all. The wall is a wall on your view, right? And so John Gollinger led the...
This is a wall... against your view that is then other people's views.
No, yeah,
it's a wall in front of a wall that's already there. Like the people who didn't want the wall because they were sitting on their own wall on the waterfront and they didn't want someone to put a wall right in front of their wall.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, views are never destroyed. But basically, there's some rich people who have a view and the proposal was to build in Washington so different rich people would have a view. I don't have a view either way, so I can give a fuck about any of their views. And we lost out on $7 million a year of, an increment in property taxes. That's a lot of money. That could pay for instance, talk about the public advocate finding money for us. Anyway, so John Gollinger ran the No Wall on the Waterfront campaign. There was no opposition, really, to it, no formal opposition. That inspired me to start organizing pro-density renters. And now he's running the Save the Sierra Club Facebook page, which is very explicit about why it's important to keep the current Sierra Club leadership in power. He's making these posts like, do you want a bunch of high-rises on the waterfront like Miami? Well, if you don't, make sure that you vote against the scandalous real estate interests referring to us. So, of course, we also think that we're trying to save the Sierra Club. If you are a Sierra Club member, keep an eye out. You're going to get a very beautiful mailer that says Save the Sierra Club, and it'll tell you how to vote for our slate. Starting November 11th, and voting closes December 16th. So you have a whole month to vote on that. And we'll spam you about it a million times, I promise.
Would you say that this man, John, is like your cartoon arch nemesis that's been going on for like the whole time you've been doing this? He was your original inspiration to fight crime, and now it's come full circle. You have a final confrontation for elected positions.
I don't see this as being a final confrontation, and also there were a number of nemeses. No, in a way, it is actually kind of a good, because we're both sort of like low level like political busybodies. I feel like we are on a similar level. That answers your question.
I want to say, so on our mailer, which is really exciting for us, is, you know, now that we have proven that we get people out, we're mobilized, and we are a significant interest group of renters who really want a lot more housing, more and more politicians are willing to stick their neck out for us. And so we're going to be endorsed by President of the Board of Supervisors, London Breed. You know, that is a huge coup for us. She, when we were first these, like, cracked out teenagers on the scene, you know, she wasn't sure, you know, A, like, what's going on with these people? You know, they come to planning commission hearings and just shout, you know, what is this? So, you know, now we are a real force, and that's really exciting. I mean, I think Miami's tacky.
I don't think Miami's tacky at all. I think it's a totally fun place for young people, especially. Like, I don't think the – I think the idea that tackiness is sort of an aesthetic virtue is poisonous in a lot of ways, and I think – a lot of young people just want a place where they can feel at home with other young people. And it's the city's job to provide that. And the whole idea of, like when we say things is tacky, what we're really saying is that, like, neighborhood character is this sublime attribute that sort of transcends, like, sort of objective qualification, and that, like, this city doesn't have it, but this city does. But all this neighborhood character stuff is just a product of people wanting to live there. And I think Miami is actually a totally desirable place to live. Miami Herald is a great paper. And, you know, the water is nice. Like, it's totally fine. Like, I like it.
Yeah, I mean, we would be very lucky to have beaches as beautiful as Miami, people as beautiful as Miami. And unfortunately, there's nothing, no matter how many high-rises we build in hoping of having, like, a cargo called Miami, it'll actually never happen.
I think one thing Miami, you know, they don't do is the public transportation as well as they could. You know, they're a little bit more car-centric than I think we would like. You know, having the ability to have density also means that you can have vibrant first-story retail. To me, you know, where do you feel like, you know, tackiness comes from the people who choose to live there and build that community, and it's a preference thing, and it sort of doesn't matter if I find it tacky, if other people are choosing that and enjoying that lifestyle. You know, who cares? Who am I to, like, determine that somebody else is tacky? I mean, like, I will be a judgmental bitch, but, like, that's fine. I think it's great that you have all of, like, small businesses and a vibrant commercial culture where people can go and find success. Like, that's what it, you know, I don't care. I don't like LA. Well, a lot of people like LA, you know, so I'm not going to move to LA, but there should be enough housing so that people who like LA can go to LA and find opportunity there.
Yeah. And Laura, this is really where you and I and the other YIMBYs differ from the residentialist, from the so-called progressives, is that they view tackiness not just as an aesthetic question, but as an ethical question. People who are tacky are somehow less valuable, that it is the job of government to legislate out tackiness, that we need to codify neighborhood character via objective criteria. I think all of us here would think this is crazy. Like, who am I to judge that you should not have redesign your home in this faux gothic with pink paint and seashells? I don't know. That sounds kind of fun, right? That should be a legal thing to do, but it's not in many neighborhoods in San Francisco.
No, it's so ironic to me that the city that has, like, nurtured the most drag queens is like the arbiter of tackiness, right? Of saying, like, no, those condos, you know, are very, like, tacky. I don't like them at all. I'm like, you know, tackiness is pretty delightful. You know, we so in the AMA, we had a conversation. Somebody asked us what aesthetic things would we do we actually think should be legislated? And I had two. My first one's that the way we incentivize open space ends up meaning that a lot of these developers create these kind of, like, inhuman, you know, corporate Stalinist plazas where they don't actually want anyone to hang out in their plazas. You know, instead of, I think we could do something to regulate those open spaces. Maybe they should even actually be owned by the government instead of by the companies that build, you know, the developers that built them. And the other thing I said is we need to do more aesthetically about first story retail. That needs to be very approachable. You know, sometimes they just build the building flat down, and they don't really, there isn't an incentive to really want there to necessarily be shops and vibrancy in those first story retails. I'd be perfectly happy with aesthetic things taken into account when it comes to first story retail. And other than that, I'm like, I don't care if you think it's ugly. You don't live there. Look away. You know, like, just keep walking. In the same way that you're going to have to live next door to somebody who looks different and acts differently than you are, and you're going to have to get used to that, and that's called becoming a better society, you're going to have to look at things that you think are ugly. And that's just like part of the grand bargain of living in a city. If you don't want to look at anyone or anything that you might find objectionable, then you're going to have to go and live in rural America all by your little self. That's what being a city and a citizen of a city means.
Burn.
Dang, dude.
I think that's really well said and exactly right. And what this shows is that many so-called progressives don't actually want to live in cities. They want to live in an idea. Like, they have a certain idea of what San Francisco should be, what it should look like, who should live here. As we've mentioned on previous podcasts, you know, progressive extraordinaire Tim Redman has proposed a type of internal passport control system where newcomers need to wait in Stockton before being permitted to move here. I don't know what the people of Stockton think about that idea. I'm sure he couldn't care less. but, you know, the one thing I did also want to say is that ground floor activation actually, I think, is an appropriate area as well to have some sort of public regulations, because what you find is that what really matters in a vibrant street isn't how tall something is. It really isn't the scale. Scale is like one of the dopiest, most misused concepts in all of urban planning and architecture anyways. It's what does it feel like as you're a human between, you know, 4 foot something and maybe up to 7 foot something. What does it feel like as you're walking around, as you're looking side to side? That's the first floor. If you get the first floor right, you know, what you do above that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and this is why – so I spent a couple of months living out in the Richmond, and I had this moment where I was like, I do not understand all the people who are trying to preserve the Richmond, because I found it very depressing. There was no coffee shop for me to walk to. There was no grocery store for me to walk to. It was – I felt very isolated. I was along Geary, which is this major boulevard that supposedly has the opportunity for there to be some retail. But, you know, there are vast areas of it where, you know, everyone's just bombing along past. And, you know, when we finally started really looking at the zoning map, I was like, oh – that's why my neighborhood was so depressing, is because there is just almost no first-story retail even allowed. So it was all this residential area and really, like, no opportunity. I wanted to spend money at a coffee shop, and when I wanted to spend money at a coffee shop, I got on the bus and went 20 minutes into the city. You know, there was a real opportunity for us to have more places where more community was built. And there, I don't want to, like, totally – like, there are great places in the Richmond, you know, but I think we have constrained them. There could be so many more wonderful places in the Richmond if we were to allow more people and more businesses to be there. You know, and another piece of it that would make it really wonderful is if we had Muni that went out there and transported people around. You know, the West Side is kind of left off in this straggling zone where they don't have enough bus rapid transit. They don't have the Muni that we could totally build out there. You know, there's this weird thing where the Richmond and the Sunset are strangely disconnected from one another. Despite being very physically close, they don't have any really relationship with one another because we don't have public transportation that easily brings people from one side of the park to the other.
Or even private transportation. I mean, the park's a pain in the ass to get through, as nice as it is. I mean, you have like big roads that just end at the park, and you know, it's just not that convenient.
Yeah, I was really struck when I moved here at how underutilized Golden Gate Park is.
Yeah.
You know, compared to, you know, Central Park and other major parks I've seen in cities, I was like, why is this, you know, you can walk and just not see anybody for a while. And like, you know, I went to, I mean, I'm not saying that people don't, like, people really enjoy, you know, Golden Gate Park. There's people biking there and whatnot. But for how magnificent it is really underutilized. And that comes from the inability for people to really get there, and also from the lack of density around the park. Central Park has tons of people who are in walking distance of that park, and Golden Gate Park is like artificially low density out there. People would love to live right near that park.
you know, it's not just that there are a lot of people who can walk Central Park. Central Park itself is flanked by high rises.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, if you look at an aerial photograph of Central Park, and it's beautiful. It's just beautiful urbanism. Like, here is this, well, sort of natural oasis in the middle of this hyper dense city. You go to Golden Gate Park, and they're just, you know, single family homes that are surrounding it. Now they're attached or they're row homes, but yeah, we could be doing much, much better.
I think that speaks to also like our sort of philosophy of when you do density, you know, you're reducing sprawl. You can preserve beautiful parks and have them be really well utilized parks and wonderful open space if and when you build a lot of housing nearby that so that people can actually use it and enjoy it. And then you're preserving, I mean, this is all part of our sort of needing to get the Sierra Club back on track. They are saying no housing, and therefore they are, you know, by saying no housing in San Francisco, you are directly incentivizing suburban sprawl. And that's just something that the Sierra Club, by its very nature, should be opposed to.
Do you want to cover any of the other ways that you're organizing? Post-election or even now?
One thing that we haven't started yet, but I'd like our volunteers to start thinking about how we can make this work, is to have precinct captains for workplaces. You know, the way that many cities have, political movements have organized before, is you have like a precinct captain that's like their captain for their neighborhood. They know their neighbors. They go out. What we really want to do is to have folks who are in their workplaces to be responsible for organizing their workplaces for the YIMBY party. Now, we know you're not going to get everyone to come out to everything, but if there's a call to action, we want you to be able to tap into your network that you've already built out and then send your people to somewhere or have them email someone or have them just click their name on an online form that then will automatically print and mail a postcard to an elected official. Like, that's the sort of stuff that we want to be able to do and want to be able to do it very quickly. But the only way that will work is if these networks already exist.
Yeah, and the YIMBY chapter organizations are going to be critical. We've had a lot of people reach out to us, you know, from as far away as like, you know, Vancouver and DC, people who want to see a YIMBY movement happening in there. I mean, it's really funny for me. I feel like we're kind of like podunk here. And then, you know, we have people across the country who are like, look at you guys, you know, you're doing the leadership of this movement. And I'm like, oh, wow, like, we're not so crappy. Yay. You know, they want advice from us. So we're going to be working on basically a how-to manual starter kit for these chapter organizations that really breaks down, you know, how and why we did things the way we did. When were we in unincorporated clubs and why was that really useful? And how does that mean you can relate to elected officials? And then when did we incorporate a 501c4 and why did we do a c4 and then how and why we did a c3 and then the PAC, and also making sure that people know, like, when you incorporate a PAC, you have to like be legal and there are issues with that. And so how to help people stay on the right side of the law with campaign finance laws, as well as really get people in their communities organized around this issue, because it has to be local. Like, you live in a physical place and that is where you are going to be able to advocate for housing. You know, all politics is local.
Let's hear some announcements. Brian?
Thank you, Vincent. On December 7th, 6:30 p.m. at the YIMBY Clubhouse, I'm going to be moderating a panel discussion called Race, Class, and Place, Uneven Impacts of the Housing Shortage. This is going to be a great panel discussion. We're going to have booze and food as well. And the folks who are going to be speaking are Ben Metcalf, who's the director for the Department of Housing and Community Development for the state of California, Tamika Moss, who's chief of staff to the mayor of Oakland, Michael Lenz, who we're flying up from LA. He's a professor of planning at UCLA, and he's done a lot of really amazing scholarship in this area. And Kate Downing, who is the co-founder of Palo Alto Forward and the former planning commissioner of Palo Alto, who wrote that incredible letter that went viral about how Palo Alto is not building enough housing and these all the negative effects that it's causing. So I want really the discussion to focus on not only the housing scholarship, but the local effects of like what are the impacts in very different communities like Palo Alto and Oakland, and how are communities like Palo Alto exporting displacement and high home prices and other problems to much poorer communities like Oakland? And then what can the state do to step in and mitigate the housing shortage?
And then for some fun things, I mean, that'll be fun too.
This is going to be very fun, Laura.
More uplifting? I don't know. We are going to have, on the day after the election, Wednesday, we're going to have a chill session here at the MB Clubhouse where people can just come and hang and decompress and hopefully not discuss how we're all moving to Canada.
Yeah, hold each other and cry.
Yeah. And then December 10th, we're going to have an urbanist art show. And so we're going to have artists who celebrate urban vibrancy in San Francisco. And we're going to have some house music for housing. Yes.
Finally.
And all of that is going to be on December 10th. So we're going to have sort of starting out around 3 or 4, I think, and going into the late evening. It'll be really fun. You can come and buy some Christmas or Hanukkah or what have you gifts. That'll be really fun. And we're going to be doing a lot more sort of panel discussions and other events in the coming months. So, you know, keep in mind, this is just the beginning.
I just want to say, the idea that house music is more fun than a discussion about how restrictive land use policy creates hyper-segregation of wealth is just beyond me, but all right, too soon, I guess.
All right. So you should do a thanks so much for listening.
Thanks so much for listening. This has been Vincent, Laura, Brian, and Sonia. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.